Welcome to Clear Creek Sunday Cast.
So anyway, let's jump in. I want to read the beginning of an article. This one was on CNET. There are several different places online, but it starts this way. Linda Chamberlain is cheerful as she shows me her husband's... Oh, wait, wrong page. Sorry. Linda Chamberlain works just down the hallway from her husband. She walks past him every day. Occasionally, she'll stop by to check in on him and say hello. The only problem is Fred Chamberlain has been dead for 8 years. Shortly after he was pronounced legally dead from a battle with cancer, Fred was cryopreserved. His body was filled with a medical-grade antifreeze, cooled to minus 196 degrees Celsius, and carefully lowered into a giant vat of liquid nitrogen. So when Linda visits Fred, she talks to him through the insulated stainless steel wall of a 10-foot-tall preservation chamber. And he's not alone in there. 8 people reside in that massive cylinder along with him. And according to the Alcor website, which I looked at this week, there are 227 bodies currently preserved in liquid nitrogen in that same room. All of them have elected to have their bodies stored in sub-zero temperatures to await a future when they could be brought back to life. So Linda Chamberlain is cheerful as she shows me her husband's perhaps not final resting place. She places her hand on the cool steel and gives it a loving pat. Being in a room with 227 dead people isn't morbid to her. It makes me feel happy, she says, because I know they have the potential to be restored to life and health, and I have the potential of being with them again. And I wonder if it occurred to her that if they bring Fred back, she's going to be 20 years older than he is, or 30, or I don't know. Alcor proclaims itself a world leader in cryonics, offering customers the chance to preserve their bodies indefinitely until they can be restored to full health and function through medical discoveries that have yet to be made. For the low price of $220,000, Alcor is selling the chance to live a second life. Okay, I did some quick math. 227 bodies at $220,000 apiece. That's $49,940,000 Alcor has collected. But that's just the ones already preserved. They've also sold over 1,400 memberships where people are making installment payments to a tune of over $300 million. And I'm saying if you're looking for an investment growth opportunity, this might be it. Because here's the reality. Nobody wants to die. Even Christian people who have hope beyond this life, who have the promise of God that we will be born in a new kingdom with new bodies, when we have the promise of eternal life, which is not just a span of days, but it's a quality of oneness with Jesus, even Christian people don't want to die. We don't even like to talk about dying. It's one of the things that I think we pretty much all have in common. You know, if you go to a social gathering, a cocktail party, whatever, and you're meeting people, you look for common ground. Where'd you go to school? Oh, really? Me too. I just found out that I share a birthday with someone here this morning. Same day, same year, probably not the same time, not sure. You find commonality. Oh, me too. Oh, you worked with them. Oh, you went to vacation there. We too. Nobody ever goes to a party and says, so have you bought your cemetery plot yet? Have you planned your funeral? Why don't we? It's the one thing we all have in common. Of course, there are lots of explanations. Cultural differences, religious backgrounds. There's just so much that's unknown about what happens next. Misunderstandings about the nature of the afterlife. Some people just say, man, I don't want to miss out. One guy in one of these articles says, I love my hot tub too much to die. I was like, really? That must be a really good hot tub. But I think at the root, we're uncomfortable talking about death, uncomfortable thinking about death, because we were never actually meant to die. We were created for an eternal fellowship with God. That's the point of the story in Genesis of the Garden of Eden, where God gives them access to the tree of life. You can eat from this tree forever. We'll have never-ending communion, never-ending fellowship, never-ending partnership in expanding my kingdom. But the story is that because of sin, that fellowship was disrupted. They were barred from access to the tree. There had to be consequences for their disobedience. So in Genesis chapter 6, after the people are becoming more and more rebellious, the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever. For they have become mortal. Their days will be 120 years. God put a limit on human lifespan. In Psalm 90, the psalmist says that the length of our days is 70 years or 80 if we have the strength, and their span is nothing but toil and trouble, and then we fly away. So even though God made the rule that because of your sin, you're separated from the tree of life, even though God designed the system so that we would have to die, I believe that every death is an offense to God because it's not what he wanted. Every death that occurs is a reminder of the disruption of our relationship, of the broken fellowship. Now, I know that raises a lot of questions. I mean, when you read the Old Testament, there are a lot of deaths that can be attributed to God. I think two things to look at there. One, because God is holy, there have to be consequences. He cannot go back on his word. He cannot tolerate the presence of sin. So God allows us to experience the consequences of our autonomy, our desire to make our own choices, even when those consequences seem disproportionate to us. But secondly, when you ask the question, what about all those deaths? You have to look to Jesus as the full revelation of who God is. And when you look at the ministry of Jesus, he never attended a funeral that he didn't ruin. He had three encounters with dead people, each of which ended with a party that nobody saw coming. The first in Luke chapter 7 says, as he approached a town gate, a town called Nain, a dead person was being carried out, the only son of his mother. And she was a widow, and a large crowd from the town was with her. And when the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her. And he said, "Don't cry." And he went up and he touched the bier, which would have made him unclean. But you're not unclean when there's not a dead body anymore, because the young man rose to life. In Luke chapter 8, a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house because his only daughter, a girl about 12, was dying. If you know the story, by the time they got to the house, the girl was dead. Again, Jesus touched her, which would have made him unclean. The Chosen does a good job with portraying this. They're questioning Jesus, "Did you touch a dead body?" And Jesus said, "Where's the dead body?" Because he brought her back to life. And then in John chapter 11, his friend Lazarus has died, and Jesus comes and interplay with Martha and Mary, "Your brother will rise again." And he says, "Open the tomb." And in King James, Martha says, "But Lord, he stinketh because he's been there 4 days." Jesus said, "I tell you, believe, you will see the glory of God." And then verse 38, Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." And he calls Lazarus, "Come forth," and Lazarus comes out of the tomb. Jesus never went to a funeral that he didn't ruin. And it tells us motivations for why he did that here. He took compassion on the widow. His heart went out to her. Her son was the only means of her support. So he had compassion. Jairus, an influential synagogue leader, pleaded with Jesus, and in response to his pleading and knowing that this would be a powerful testimony to the community, raises his daughter. He loved Lazarus. He loved his sisters, but even more, he wanted people to believe that he was who he said he was. But I think beyond all those motivations, at the root, I believe that death is an offense to God. When the incorruptible encountered the ultimate symbol of human corruptibility, when the immortal came face to face with mortality, when the author of creation was confronted with the decay or the decreation of death, he couldn't let it stand. He had to make it right. Now, in reading some of those articles about the cryogenics, body preservation, about people who are looking for an escape from death, the preponderance of which are extremely wealthy white men, and I don't know why that mattered, but it was part of the story. Here's what it said. The biggest difficulty is not whether it is possible to recover a whole person from ultra-low temperatures. There is a reasonable chance that will happen in the future. It is the fact that when they're thawed out, they will be dead. If they were dead when they were frozen, they will still be very much dead when you thaw them out. Then what have you accomplished? See, that's a problem science hasn't solved. It's not a problem for Jesus. Jesus said, "No, I can make life happen. But if death is an offense to God, so much so that it prompted Jesus to reverse it when he encountered it, then I think we're justified in treating death as an unwelcome intruder. It's okay that we're not comfortable with death. And yet, well, there was one death that Jesus encountered, that he confronted, that he didn't oppose. He didn't try to reverse. He didn't overturn. But instead, he embraced that death. And that would be his own. So in this series called The Cross-Centered Life, well, there was a point in Jesus' ministry, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, at Caesarea Philippi, when Peter made his confession, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And immediately in Matthew 16, it says, from that time on, because Jesus knew, okay, I've accomplished what I came to do, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed. Next chapter, Matthew 17, when they came together in Galilee, he said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him." Luke 18, Jesus took the 12 aside and told them, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and everything that's written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled. He will be delivered over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, insult him, and spit on him. They will flog him and kill him." Jesus knew that his death was inevitable. Not only that, he knew that it was necessary. And his singularity of intent informed every choice he made, every action he took, every miracle he performed, every relationship he prioritized, every word he spoke. Death was both an inevitability and a choice that shaped every part of his life. The question is, well, okay, that's Jesus. What does that have to do with us? I was listening to a podcast, the Good Faith Podcast, and well worth listening to. Curtis Chang is a pastor who just talks about life issues. I don't know, but he interviewed, the reason I listened to this episode, a lady named Nancy French. She's a writer, investigative journalist. Her husband's a columnist for the New York Times, a conservative. And because I follow her husband on Twitter, I knew that she had been diagnosed with a very aggressive form of breast cancer a few months ago. And so this podcast episode was how we talk about cancer. And so I thought that's something I want to listen to. And so she was 4 months after diagnosis, halfway through her treatment, her aggressive treatment, when she recorded this podcast. So it's very raw, very real. I mean, she's right in the middle of it. And she was just talking about how uncomfortable people are with the idea of death. And when they find out that she has cancer, the things that they say, like, "I'm sure you're going to be fine." She said, "You can't be sure that I'm going to be fine." But here's what she said. She said, "Once people know that I have cancer, I'm no longer a person to them. I'm a projection of their greatest fears. Because they look at me and they don't see me, they see death." Now, she said for her, it's been a very clarifying experience. In fact, she said her whole family is getting memento mori tattoos. Anybody familiar with memento mori? Okay, sometimes you see it as an hourglass, sometimes there are skulls, sometimes there are wilted flowers. It's an idea that has its roots in Christian tradition. There are Puritan churches in the Northeast especially where it's engraved in limestone, memento mori. It's a Latin phrase that simply means remember that you must die. And so her whole family, in response to her cancer, is getting tattoos. Now, her cancer is treatable. She might not die from this. She said, "Well, what I've realized is if I don't die from this, I'm going to die from something." We all are. And she said, "You have to embrace the reality of your death to fully live out your days." And she said, remembering that you're going to die allows you to be more courageous if you aren't trying to hold on to this life at all costs. It sets you, it frees you to live more fully. So that there is, isn't this happy, cheerful talk? I think it will be before we're done. There is an inevitability. I don't know why I put that word in this sermon six times. I can't say it once. There is an inevitability to death that if we confront it properly shapes the way we live. It's going to happen. Let's live in response to that. But just like Jesus, death is also a choice that we can make. And that's reflected in things that Jesus said to his disciples, just like in the video that we used again this morning. I want to read that scripture again in light of memento mori. Remember that you must die. Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever chooses to lose their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? What can anyone give in exchange for their soul?" So as we talk about a cross-centered life, yeah, we live in reflection on the death of Jesus and everything that it accomplished, the forgiveness that we have, the reconciliation with God, the promise of eternity with Him, all of those things that it accomplished. But it's not just remembering His death. The cross-centered life is to live with a willingness to die every day. The cross-centered life isn't just a look at the way Jesus lived. It's a look at the way He calls us to live in response. And the way to live a cross-centered life is to stack up a collection of cross-centered days. Every day we have the opportunity to choose. Am I going to save my life or am I going to lose it? Do I truly believe that losing my life, giving up my life, is the way to true life? Here's how the apostles described this daily death I'm talking about. In Romans 8, Paul's talking about a life guided by the Spirit of God rather than by our human impulses. He says in Romans 8, 12, "Therefore, brothers and sisters, we have an obligation, but it is not to the flesh to live according to it. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the misdeeds of the body, you will live." Colossians 3, here's that phrase again. "Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, greed, which is idolatry." He talks about the wrath of God and the judgment and what Jesus did to rescue us from that. "Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility." Choose to die so you can put on life. Galatians 5, he says, "So I say, walk by the Spirit, you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the flesh desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit what is contrary to the flesh. They're in conflict with each other so that you're not to do whatever you want. You have to choose to die to yourself." He goes on to say the acts of the sinful nature are obvious, and he lists all these sins. But then he says the life born from putting to death your natural impulse and embracing the saving, transforming work of Christ is so much better. It looks like love and joy and peace and patience and all the fruit of the Spirit. We believe that the eternal life of Jesus, again, not just a quantity of days forever, but a quality of life with Him, that begins when we accept His call to follow Him, when we die to ourselves by repenting of our sins and confessing Him as the worthy Lord and being immersed into His life. And Andy Stanley says, you know, following Jesus won't necessarily make your life better. I mean, dying isn't easy. He said, but it will make you better at life. Because there's a direct correlation between choosing to die and experiencing true life. For example, if you're married, there's every opportunity to dig in your heels and say, "I'm right." Or you can choose to die. Paul said, "Husbands, love your wives like Christ loved the church and gave himself for her." And you can say, "You know what? It's not worth being right for the death it brings to this relationship. I will die so we can live." When it comes to money, you can say, I got to get all that I can. I got to have it all because that's where my happiness is, and that's where my security is. And that, you can say, you know what? I'm going to die to that impulse. I'm going to crucify that impulse and be generous and experience the life of generosity that God has given to me. I'm going to partner with him in that. When it comes to our politics, do I need to say more? We can't affect things on a national scale anyway, but we can affect things right next to us by choosing to die and saying, I'm going to give you the grace to be wrong and not even tell you about it. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll be looking at the Last Supper and the things that Jesus said and did there. But at the core of his teaching, his final, most important teaching, he said, this is why you're here. To this you were called, a life of radical, selfless, serving, sacrificial love. I'm calling you to die to yourself for the good of others. And here's why we believe that's the best way to live. Because even though Jesus' life was profoundly shaped by his impending death, we know that's not the end of the story. I read those scriptures earlier where Jesus told his disciples, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. They're going to kill me. I'm going to die. But that's not all he said. Matthew 16. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Matthew 17, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised to life. Luke 18, we're going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the Gentiles, and they will mock him, insult him, spit on him, they will flog him and kill him. On the third day he will rise again. Now, the disciples of Jesus were used to him speaking in metaphors, and they thought this was another one of those they didn't understand. He was being literal. They're actually going to kill me. I'm actually going to rise again. So they were shocked when he actually died. They were stunned when he actually rose again. But after those two things happened, we'll talk about this on Easter Sunday, death no longer had a terror for them. They saw death for what it is because they saw life in all its possibility. Paul called death the last enemy to be destroyed, because it is still a painful reality in our world. But it has to be destroyed. It's already been defeated. Nancy French, in talking about her cancer, said, if I die, don't say I lost my battle with cancer, because the battle was already won. I've gone on to life. We can embrace the reality of our literal physical deaths, because we know for followers of Jesus, it's the doorway to life. But even better than that, we can, because of Jesus, living lives centered on the cross, because we're aware of the empty tomb, we can embrace the daily choice to die to ourselves, to make more and more room for the life Jesus came to bring, so it can be born in us, so it can be shaped in us, so it can be brought to life in us in new ways. I want to read this quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a well-known quote with a little more context. He says, the cross is laid on every Christian. As we embark upon discipleship, we surrender ourselves to Christ in union with his death. We give over our lives to death. And thus it begins. The cross is not the terrible end to an otherwise God-fearing and happy life, but it meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ. And then the famous line that he's known best for, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. That's the choice we all get to make every day. I want to go to invite the worship team up. They're going to sing a song that's going to lead us into communion. But as we come into that time, I just want to give you some questions for reflection this morning. I wonder, what impact does death have on your life? Like, if you actually acknowledge the reality of, I will physically actually one day die. If you acknowledge that, how does that change your priorities? If you know that you're going to die, if you knew you were going to die tomorrow, what conversations would you have today? How would you pray differently if you knew that your opportunity to influence was going to end? Even beyond that, when you consider the daily death that we're called to embrace, dying to self and living by the Spirit, what relationship could improve if you were willing to think a little less of yourself and put the other person first? You know what? It's not worth it. This can be better. What would you hold on to a little more loosely, knowing that it would make more room for the life he has for you? If you choose to die today the way that we're called to die, what behavior would you say, yeah, that needs to change? Who would you forgive? As we sing, as we prepare for communion, let's reflect on the death of Jesus, but also on the life we have because of Jesus.